farthest frontier of known reality, there lies an undiscovered country, a realm of mirrors and truths and the unexpected. If you dare not travel in such a country, then we urge you, tune out now. But if you hunger for high adventure and life at the extreme edge, then welcome to Dreamland. Now available online on unknowncountry.com and on the IBC radio network at 7.385 kHz shortwave from 11 until 12:30 Eastern Time on Saturday nights, repeated weeknights Eastern at 1 a.m. Well, this is Whitley Strieber. Welcome to another edition of Dreamland. We're back with, this week, we're going to be talking to Amy Wallace, who, Irving Wallace's daughter, who was, for 20 years, an intimate of Carlos Castaneda, and she's got some absolutely fascinating things to say about this very, very secretive guy. Also, in the past few months, has been an extremely intensive period of UFO activity, very intensive just recently. There is some new UFO video, which we are analyzing right now, and it's going to be up on our website quite soon. This video is almost indisputably real, and it ends the controversy. There are UFOs out there. The video is really indisputable. It will be ignored by the media, of course, but they're hiding their heads in the sand. I want you to make a special effort this week to look at a few things on unknowncountry.com. Go to the Insight section. You do that by clicking on the Mind Frame tab. The last entry is called Insight. Read that carefully. That is the best story of a close encounter slash abduction I've ever read. It's a very, very disturbing one. One of the individuals involved apparently has a radiation burn. They are both very shattered by what happened to them, and it is an example of what is going to continue on in the close encounter experience. In addition, there, at the end of this radio program, there is 10 minutes or so of an interview with Brian Vike, who is the very excellent researcher in British Columbia, who is working on this extraordinary series of UFO events that are taking place up there. Very large-scale sightings with hundreds of people involved. One of the best pieces of UFO video ever recorded. And an abduction case where the UFOs involved in the abduction were witnessed by different people from a number of different directions. And there are disturbing physical traces of the UFO encounter left as well. This is powerful stuff, and as I said last October, I asked the question, will 2003 be the year of the alien? Well, it certainly is so far. This is probably the most extensive concentration of different types of UFO slash close encounter activity happening in one place at one time ever. So it's extraordinary. Go to also read my journal. Read the journal entry carefully if you're interested in this, and please, I'm getting people who are reading this journal entry who keep writing me and saying, oh, well, at last you've decided that the aliens are evil. Oh, well, or why have you changed your mind and now you're saying they're evil? Just get past it, okay? Please try to. This is not about good or evil aliens. This is not Flash Gordon. We're dealing with real life here. Let me ask you a question. Is mankind good or evil? Jesus Christ was born of mankind. So was Adolf Hitler. So what does that make us? The answer is we're a lot of different things, and so are the visitors. So when I talk about the dark side of the visitors, or I talk about the good side of the visitors, I'm talking about a real life complicated issue involving a very strange phenomenon, which may be aliens and may be something entirely different. But get past the idea that they're either all good or all evil and that I'm somehow vacillating. I'm trying to talk about something real. Real. Okay. Anyway, in the path, there is a card called the Hanged Man, which is also known as the Dancer. I have included in my journal entry the full material from the path about that card. if we are going to succeed in developing the close encounter experience into something that we can use for ourselves, we have to be the dancer. It's going to be hard. But if something awful happens, as it will, the aliens are not all evil, or the visitors, whatever they are. If something wonderful happens because of them, they are not all good. They are real. And real is complicated, subtle, and ambiguous, and we just have to live with that. Have to live with it, okay? So, do the meditations. A lot of you are doing the meditations. That will work to get you into contact with higher levels of this thing. That kind, that restructuring and redirectioning of your energy does work. I know it works. I know how to do this. I'm doing this all the time. I've known it for 15 years. I have grown enormously because of my encounter experience for 15 years. And I got beaten up and roughed up and also taken practically to the gates of heaven. You can do it too. We can make this work for ourselves, but it is going to be hard because what is out there, you have no idea what it's going to be like if this thing ever gets on the ground in a big way here. This is going to change this world. It is going to make a lot of lives real, real hard. In order to be free and to remain fully human under those circumstances, you're going to have your integrity intact. Now, next week, we're going to be talking about integrity with an author who knows something real about the human soul. Don't miss that either. Don't miss any of this stuff, because God knows what could happen to me right now. I'm in the middle of something that is a whole lot bigger than most people realize, and there are those who know that and who might want to remove this voice so you listen to it while it's here. Don't take this as entertainment. It's not entertainment anymore. This is becoming real serious, okay? Okay, now we're going to go and we're going to listen to Carlos, Amy Wallace talk to us about Carlos Castaneda. Then Linda has a great report on Yellowstone. What is really happening out there? Is the whole thing about to blow up in our faces? Well, we'll find out later on. And then Brian Vike will be with us to talk a little bit about what's going on in British Columbia, and subscribers can listen to and download the whole interview, and non-subscribers can listen to it at least on the on this same site that you're on right now by going down to the bottom of the page and clicking on Listen Now. Next week we'll go back to the meditations, so keep tuned and keep your head on. It's going to be real interesting times. By the way, crop circles all over the world ceased on August the 10th. That was the last crop circle formation that appeared anywhere in the world except, guess where? In Canada. Canada is being focused on by the visitors right now on every level. The Canadians are liable to be our first ambassadors and victims. Well, let's keep our prayerful hearts open and remember, you gather your integrity now, and always is the time. Your integrity is your key to your own freedom and the future of this species. What do I mean by integrity? Read the journal entry and listen to next week's show. You know, there's no other place in the world you can get information like this. I urge you to keep it going by subscribing to unknowncountry.com. Probably you have not subscribed. Most of you haven't. About 1% of our newsletter readers have subscribed, and less than one half of 1% of our listeners to this radio program have subscribed. Less than one half of 1% of you have subscribed, but it's all dependent on you. If you lose this, and you could lose this now, that would be very sad. Take responsibility for this website. I put my time, my effort, my money into it. Annie does too, and so many other people do. You put a little of your money into it as well. We need you. Go to unknowncountry.com. Click on that subscribe tab. Enough said. This is Whitley Strieber at Streamland. We have Amy Wallace with us, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, Her Life with Carlos Castaneda. You remember, of course, Carlos Castaneda. How could you forget? He was a multi-million copy bestseller, highly controversial, a major celebrity, extremely reclusive. Well, guess who was behind the curtain with him? Hello, Amy.
Hello, Whitley. Hello, Anne.
Hi, Amy.
Anne is with us, too, I might add. The three of us are going to be talking out of school about Carlos Castaneda, someone who I guess I came across his books back in the 60s and when they were first starting out, and I was as fascinated and riveted as anybody. And I have to ask you, Amy, how did he come into your life?
Well, of course, I did read the first book, like everybody of my generation, the first book about Don Juan, the famous shaman that Carlos met in Mexico when he was an anthropologist, theoretically. But my father was the novelist Irving Wallace.
Yes.
And I grew up in an environment where I met Henry Miller and Alex Haley and Sidney Sheldon, and the whole writers were all around our house. And so my father had access to incredible people, and I was never impressed because I was a rebellious teenager, except, you know, I liked some people and not others. And there were only two times in my life when I was impressed. The first was when he met John Lennon, and the second time was when he came home and said, "I just met Carlos Castaneda," and I was 17. And he said, "I want you to meet him." And I said, for the only time that I can recall, I said, "I'm too scared." And he said, "I insist." And my father was a very forceful and dynamic person, so I said, "Okay, all right then." And we went to a dinner party that was arranged with my brother and Carlos and one of his mysterious female companions who appears in Sorcerer's Apprentice. But at the time...
Which one was this?
Pardon me?
Was this Florinda?
This was Taisha.
Taisha.
Taisha, but she was going by another name. Everybody had several names in this group, but at that time I didn't know any of these things. And I was nervous, and I was 17, and there was this charming man who just was all smiles and warmth and kindness and exuding welcome, and I forgot to be nervous. And from that moment on, it was impossible to be nervous around Carlos. Until many years later.
You would think it would be the opposite.
Oh, indeed. But he was I think he was the best storyteller I've ever met. And he and my father together made quite a team. And it was, because my father told wonderful stories. And it was one of the liveliest dinner parties I've ever been to. And he had his stitches laughing. But he did not talk about strange and mysterious supernatural things. He was like a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And so he put everyone at their ease, and when we were parting, he gave me a very intense look, very, very beautiful, intense eyes, and said, "We'll meet again in this, what was a kind of a supernatural and startling way." And he stayed in touch with me for 20 years. And then it was the last 10 years when I became very close to Carlos. And you would think he would be guru-esque, but he was not at that time.
Well, I might add, by the way, let's talk. I think that we're going to sort of get into the relationship. Before we do that, I failed to mention some of the other books that you have written, some with Irving Wallace and David Wallachinsky, with your mother also, Sylvia Wallace. And I've, of course, read the books of Liszt's.
Thank you.
And The Intimate Sex Lives of Famous People, which has got to be one of the most charming and deeply human and humorous books I've ever read.
Thank you. That was a challenge to write with one's family and remain in the best of, we hope, the best of taste. I had also written a book about psychic healing, which I was
the
hands-on
book.
Manual called The Psychic Healing Book, and Carlos used to tease me about it and then secretly tell me, "Well, we know that this is all real." And that was the first book I wrote.
How did he tease you about it? I'm very interested to know that.
Pardon me?
How did Carlos tease you about it? Because that's could be kind of important. And
yes.
Why would he choose to tease you about it?
Well, it was the first thing he did tease me about when I knew him in later life and became closer to him. And he felt that it would inflate my ego if people thought that I had psychic abilities. And he used to... First he started in a public lecture by saying, "I know someone in this room who's a psychic and has a big ego," and then and that's all bunk. And then he pulled me aside later and he said, "Well, sweetie, you know, you're I just can't let people know that you have these abilities because it'll go to your head. So I have to, it's my job to tear this down.
You know, Amy, what's interesting about this is that all through your book, at different places, Carlos is talking about ego. And
yes.
Yet, it leaps from the pages of his books.
Does it not?
Yes. He had a huge ego. In fact, I would almost go so far as to say that it was one of those dreadful egos that is so big that it's mostly empty. Is that true or not?
Sadly, Carlos's ego was immense, and in my opinion, and I do believe, and here some people will disagree with me, I don't believe Carlos was a P.T. Barnum type who set out to con the masses. I think he was a seeker, and I think his self-importance, the thing he derided most in others, got in the way. And his ego was very touchy, and he couldn't stand it being grazed.
Well, Amy, one question I've always wanted to ask. Do you think there was a Don Juan, or was it all Carlos?
Well, of course, we only have my view, and I don't know if anyone will ever know definitively, but I believe Don Juan was a composite figure.
Uh-huh.
I do believe Carlos traveled in Latin countries extensively. People I knew went to a party where he prepared psychedelic plants and writes in the same way that he did in the book that you discussed. And but in Sorcerer's Apprentice, I was never given any of these plants. And he said that women had special abilities and didn't need any psychedelic plants. But I think that learning these things, and also Carlos was a tremendous linguist. He must have spoken 7 or 8 languages, and some of them were slang from Latin American countries. He obviously traveled around. I think he probably went to many rituals and met many teachers and built his composite. I had an extraordinary experience in Los Angeles here about a few months ago when I went into a bookstore and I met someone who knew Carlos at the UCLA library and had worked with him during the years he was composing his first books.
And how did this meeting come about?
Oh, I walked into the mystery bookstore in Westwood, California, and started chatting with its owner, Sheldon, a wonderful man, and he remembered Irving and my family from our bookstore rambles around Los Angeles. He said, "What are you doing?" And I told him, and he said, "My God, you're the first person in 30 years I've ever been able who's believed me, because I knew that Carlos was making up a lot of this stuff because I sat beside him at UCLA, but no one believes me." And I said, "Did Carlos ever try to pull There's One Don Juan story on you?" And the story, and he said he tried, but he knew he would give it up because he knew it was ridiculous. I would laugh. And I said, "Oh, Sheldon, I wish I'd met you. It would have been an interesting experience." But I was so deeply in at a certain point, which we'll talk about later, that I don't think I would have been swayed.
Well, wasn't his background kind of a mystery? I mean, his education and where he really came from, and didn't he have a lot of cover stories?
Oh, my goodness. He, one of the women I referred to, the one who was closest to him, I think, was name was Belinda, who also wrote, she said, "I lie so much I can't even remember my own birthday." And then she told me her birthday, but she did barely remember it. But Carlos had many names. He was married over and over again. He would marry people and tell them it was for his first marriage. He actually was from Cajamarca, Peru. He told people he was from Brazil, and then sometimes he would tell them he was from Mexico. So he had countless cover stories, and he would often allude to strange backgrounds where he was a murderer and in mysterious military forces, but he never said what they were. This is also part of his, he would have said, if you said, "Carlos, you know, I see here there's research done by an anthropologist," you wouldn't say this to Carlos because he would bite your head off, but if you were to say, "Get this in," that defies what you're saying, he would have said, "Well, I'm stalking, theoretically." It would have sounded a more poetic way to say it, but he would have said, "This is stalking is something I write about in my books, and it's erasing personal history. I'm telling the story on purpose." Now, I'm making this up, Carlos. Did not speak this way. This is from the books.
Right.
But he would say this is a technique for us to break away from our pasts, and that's part of the spiritual path. Well,
so
that's
kind
path,
of a trickster type.
The coyote, the trickster, mm-hmm. They used to call him in the books. Very dangerous for some people.
It's a certain personality type I know very well because I live it. It is me. I am also a storyteller and a trickster. and people wonder about whether or not the beings that I met were real.
I have heard that you've been excoriated and...
Oh, sure.
To put it mildly.
The problem I have is a very enormous one, and that is that they were real, but because of the fact that people like Carlos so expertly blazed the trail of, frankly, fallacy, I have a lot of trouble being believed, and it ended up a very lonely road. Not that I resent what he did, because I think that as we get into talking about the warrior's way, we'll begin to see there was a lot of value there.
Well,
but
you know,
I'm not so sure that indulging the storyteller in oneself is the way to communicate this.
I did not see it as successful because I did not see it as successful in my, so to speak, training and in those around me. I didn't see it working. I remember, just to comment upon your experience, Whitley, that I was with Carlos in Mexico, and he took me to the Anthropological Museum there, which is fantastic, and it was showing me the statues and the Lord of Palenque, which is a beautiful jade statue, and we were with a Mexican friend of his who said, I'm very interested in Whitley Strieber's work and so forth, and do you think that this could be what you, Carlos, call inorganic beings? That was his term for other beings. Could that be the same as an alien being, for example? And Carlos bit his head off, and I'd never seen him do that to another person. This is early in the period when we were having a romance.
When you say he bit his head off, what do you mean?
He said, stupid in Spanish, in great length, and called him lots of names I can't say on the radio. And the poor guy kind of wilted, and then he said, no, they're what I say they are. They're different. They're inorganic beings from a different plane. That's all junk. And, he wouldn't make any room for those theories. It had to be his way.
Well, again, when the ego gets in the way, you it doesn't help you. You can't, you know, it's like going blind, and you're talking about a blind man now.
Very honest of you. If he met you, somebody like you, he probably would be very charming, and then find a way to make a story about it and how his way was better.
Oh, I would. Well,
accurate.
See, the thing is, there is no real way, but let's do talk about his concept of his way, the warrior's way, which you tried to live, and you lived, and I think probably still live to an extent.
Well, it's there. I tried it. I mean, the experience of writing Sorcerer's Apprentice really was, it was a 5-year experience, and I tried to, with a fine-tooth comb, cull the beautiful messages that Carlos gave me from the things that were destructive and ruinous to my mental health.
Ruinous. And, well, like, for example, the presence of Florinda in your relationship with Carlos, the poisonous. Florinda told me about your dress. Do you know how close you are to being kicked out? You're hanging by a thread. You wore that to get attention. You're trying to stand out to look special. Mm. Why can't you just fit in like the others? Listen.
Well, you did a very amazing imitation of the way she would do it. And then the other flip side, she'd say, you're not dressed up enough. You look like a hippie. What are you? I was from living in Berkeley.
Right.
You look like a Berkeleyite. It's like you could never quite do it right. And the idea that someone else might get attention was very threatening, often
right,
to the top tier, and then they would blow up and they would have big egos, and then they would say, but my ego, my blowing up, my getting angry is not like you. You're a human, but I'm impeccable because I'm beyond humanity, so I can throw a fit and have a scene, and that's not the same. And there's really no way to answer that.
Well, I met people in the Gurdjieff Foundation who had the same attitude about themselves. They were living that same bullshit.
How did that, did you see any successes in that group?
In the Gurdjieff work?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. It's a tremendously successful thing, but it's just real, real hard. And my teacher, my main teacher, William Siegel, told me when I was right at the height of it and just getting so deeply involved, he said, stop, leave. Put it behind you. Walk out of the foundation and never walk in again. Never do it again. You either have this now or you don't.
And how did you feel?
I walked out.
Brilliant.
I did exactly what he told me to. And I took that to mean that the rest of my life, my life task was maintaining my journey toward a greater consciousness and a more objective being. And that's what I've done. And interestingly enough, some real masters showed up about 4 years, 3 or 4 years later in the form of these visitors. I replaced Bill Siegel, and he said to me, very interesting thing, I went and told him about what had happened with these things, and he said, well, 15 seconds with them, 15 years of meditation.
My God, what a remark that is.
Yeah, well,
so
he was
moving.
A tremendous man.
Well, I mean, look at the difference here between Carlos and Mr. Siegel. I mean, Carlos would say, you're out. This is documented in kind of painful detail in Sorcerer's Apprentice, but he would say,
yes.
You're, to me or to someone else, you're out of this group. Sometimes he'd give people a certain sum of money, and he would say, and they didn't want to leave, and it would be this painful thing, and then he'd make up lots of stories about them, which he would tell to the group, and kind of blacken their name with some real falsehoods sometimes.
Well, that goes on in all of them. It went on in the Gurdjieff work, too. Oh, sure. Listen, we got to take a break. I am late on my break, as I always do seem to be, because
sorry,
I love
Whitley.
This show, and it's more fun to do it than it is to take breaks. So, this is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. Sorcerer's Apprentice by Amy Wallace, her life with Carlos Castaneda. Finally, you can find out what was really going on behind the scenes of Carlos Castaneda's life. Amy Wallace was his lover for 20 years, his friend. Amy Wallace's book, Sorcerer's Apprentice, delves into the life of one of the most mysterious and powerful men of the 20th century. Was Carlos Castaneda really a sorcerer? Did Don Juan actually exist? You'll find all of this out and more. What was really going on with this extraordinary, wonderful, and dangerous man? Get it from the UnknownCountry.com store.
This is Ann Strieber. I'm urging you to read the Communion Letters. The close encounter experience has been seriously misrepresented in the media, even in the UFO press. These letters were written by folks just like you who actually had this happen to them. They are a true representative sample of the strangest, hardest, most dangerous, and most wonderful thing that has ever happened on this planet. Available only from the UnknownCountry.com store.
This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're back. Ann and I are together today talking to Amy Wallace, Sorcerer's Apprentice, her life with Carlos Castaneda, getting behind the curtain. And Amy, we've been talking about all of the negative side of this and the limitations and so on and so forth, but there was also tremendous magic.
Yes.
Tremendous. Tell us a little bit about what that was. What was it like in the... let's start by talking about this is a wonderful, magical, it is indeed a magical chapter called A Magical Tour of the Sorcerer's Secret Home.
Thank you.
When he took you there, describe this marvelous place, that he took you and what you found there. In Westwood, of all places.
Indeed. For those of you who know California, it's a lovely, but not the toniest place in California. People think Carlos lived very high on the hog. Well, he drove a truck. He didn't drive a Rolls Royce. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it wasn't the picture people had. And it was a very big deal to be invited to his home, where he lived with three women whom he called the witches, and said were also the students of Don Juan, or this fictive character, Don Juan. And he finally invited me, and it was the most minimalist environment. It was very beautiful on the outside, very lush. He was quite a gardener. He told me there were clippings he brought from Mexico, cuttings of magical plants and magical fruits, and it was very romantic because there was this one peach blooming on a tree, and he said, eat it all now, as if I was Persephone in the garden of the underworld, and it was magical. And he took me through a house that was very plain inside, and he said, he certainly had a dramatic way. He said, there's a door we have never opened in 30 years because a witch died in there because her ego was too big. Well, later I saw the door open, but it was he created this wonderful environment. And when we got to his room...
Tell us about eating the peach.
Oh, the peach?
Yeah, do tell us.
Well, he never said it, but of course the implications are those of Greek myth, which is that one is then bound or enjoined with this magic place. He said,
right.
All of the peach. And I did, and it felt very exquisite.
He knew what he was doing. He was trying to bind you in a way to the place.
Very much so,
and I
felt bound to the place. And it made a great impression on me. There were a few little statuettes of animals, which he said were power totems. Creatures, and there was virtually nothing on the walls except a few of his book covers and frames, and his room was as minimalist as can be. No computer, no typewriter. He used to give jewels out to the women in the group, which was a very touchy point. It kind of were emblems for people. It became very competitive, but he said he used to do it to draw out our egos. So there was a pile of jewels on the table, and he kept a collection of knives under the bed, which was the one thing he collected. And there was a big box of, or what do you call it, bamboo rattan case of canes and walking sticks, which he said had come from Don Juan. And other than that, there was nothing in there. There was a room that was a library, and he really believed in living in a minimal way.
Now, she said they were from Don Juan. Did it ever? It really has crossed my mind. I've read a lot of Carlos's books and thought a lot about his work, which I consider, in many ways, quite a successful work, but not one that is likely to lead to real spiritual transformation on the part of the individual because of all the storytelling in it. However,
well, he never did what your teacher did. He never said, you've got it, now go.
He never did, no.
No,
because you never would quite get it, would you?
You could never get it, no. And so if you left, it was for bad reasons, never because, as your teacher said, go on, Whitley, you have time to go on. You know, you're in good shape, or you're in shape enough to go on. That's a big difference.
It was a devastating experience for me to leave, by the way, because, of course, he also told all the people, I was the head of a little group, and I had a big thing going. He told them all, basically, that I was leaving, and suddenly I had, you know, I was ready, I was going to do this and everything, and suddenly I had to.
Right.
And I felt bitterly kicked out.
Well, you did feel bitterly kicked out. Well, it's very painful,
yeah.
Because, you have a pseudo-family. I don't know about your situation, but Carlos directed every moment of our days.
Annie didn't buy into it much at all. I live with that. We did it together for some years, but it was not her kind of thing. And I had to respect that. Because
They didn't ban your marriage?
No. Oh,
they better not have.
They never would do that. It wasn't that kind of thing. It was
not,
really
not
very,
that kind of
it,
thing.
It was very practical and down to earth. And it wasn't about, well, let's not talk about that. I want to talk about Carlos. That's why we're here. what I want to do is I want to ask you again about Don Juan, because I have a hard time not believing that Don Juan was a real person. And could it be that he actually was and wasn't at the same time?
I believed for years in some of the notions that Carlos espoused. I still don't know what I think about all these things. I don't think I'll ever have definitive answers, whether we have an energy body, whether we can, exist in two places at one time. But there is, I believe there was a certain amount of literary conceit in the books, which was quite brilliant, where Carlos would make himself look like a bumbler, like the Candide type.
Right.
And you would read those books, especially the first three or four, and you'd think, I could do a better job if Don Juan was my teacher. And I think that was Carlos was so brilliant. I think he did that as a way of drawing the reader in, and it worked. But whether there was a real Don Juan, I have to be honest with you and say there was no one in the group who ever claimed to have met him.
Yes.
The witches claimed to have met him, but no one else in the group ever claimed to have seen or met him. which is peculiar. And there was one woman sort of outside the group. I didn't have enough room in the book to write much about her, but she was marginalized but remained there. And she, Carlos would tell us, she was the earliest student of Don Juan's. I think it's in Grocers of Press, it's discussed a little bit. And she claimed, she told someone after he died that she'd never met Don Juan, which was kind of a blow to hear
that.
Now, what did you mean by book was both there and wasn't? Can I ask you?
Well, yeah, it's there's a lot behind that phrase, and I am not at all sure, having lived the way I've lived and seen what I've seen, and I mean, I worked with for months with a man who could appear and disappear at will, and was and could appear in three or four different forms. And he was totally real, to the point Annie remembers, I think, don't you, trying to sit in the room with me when he was coming. And she heard him come.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And she couldn't stay. I mean, tell that story. Why don't you, Annie?
Oh, no, I'm not going to tell that story. But,
okay.
But the point is, things are real. There's more in heaven and
my
earth.
Point,
ratio.
Exactly.
Yes.
These
of course,
beings
I can't live my
real.
Life and not believe that. That's something I'll always. I always thought that maybe Don Juan was somebody who Carlos wove a lot of lore around. In other words, he could have been real, but I think most of the ideas were Carlos. Don't you think so?
This is what I believe, because I believe that he is. It was so brilliant and so literate, and I think he would. He knew the power and effect of maybe taking some of the great shamans he had met and the characters he had met and giving them distinctive forms. Don Genaro in the early books, a fabulous creation. But you know, we talked about Florinda Donner earlier.
Yeah.
Right.
He had a teacher who they called Big Florinda, and her name was passed on. Well, there was no, again, nobody really met this woman, but she was a great creature, an archetype in the mythos.
Well,
and
I wonder if many of the great teachers aren't really this. I mean,
yes.
How much of Jesus is really Jesus? I mean, we know there are a lot of additions to the New Testament.
Yes.
And textual scholars can find him and point him out very easily. How much of Buddha is really Buddha?
And we won't ever know.
No,
some people say, let us take the best of the teachings and leave the rest, which is what I say at the end of Sorcerer's Apprentices. I tried to take the best out of it. It was a little too much, far too much, not a little too much, I won't mince words, tough love for me and for the style of my my makeup.
Well, tough love is, if you don't need tough love is cruel.
Yes.
It's a pleasure for certain people to do that to others. Do you think Carlos took pleasure in it?
Well, I think at times. Now, we have to remember Carlos wasn't well, and he was supposed to burn by spontaneous combustion. Now, writing the Book of Lists, I read and studied about people who burned
spontaneously. It's a particularly interesting part of the Book of Lists, and inspired me to a long-term fascination with spontaneous combustion.
It's one of his obsessions.
I'll tell you, we share it. I got fascinated. I was fascinated. I wrote that list. My brother and I have kept studying it. And I, in the interim period of years when I knew Carlos in my 20s and early 30s, he took me out to a meal with Florinda. But I wasn't involved with the group. I had just gotten a divorce. He said I was still paying taxes to the world. Isn't that a great phrase?
No.
And he said, he started to tell a story about how he was in the bathtub and his big toe caught fire. And he started to burn. And Florinda kicked him under the table at the restaurant. I saw it happen. And they started talking about movies. And 10 years later, I said, what was that? I saw that. And he said, you weren't ready. But I was almost taken by this fire from within. And I know from my reading that it exists, but I used to have talks with Carlos, and I'd say, why is it that some people burn and others don't? And he just would shrug and say, I don't know, Chola. And in fact, he died of cancer. And so to get back to what we were talking about earlier, he had liver cancer, and he also had diabetes. So, and he was erratic in getting treatment, as far as I know, from what I was told. The person can become very cruel and irritable when these ailments are getting serious. I've seen it
Was he a big drinker, Amy?
Not to my knowledge. He claimed he'd shot his liver, I quote him, with psychedelic plants.
Mm-hmm.
So most I saw him take was a tiny drink. I couldn't speak for his past. But apparently there was a time when he was offered a liver transplant, I was told, and by his doctor, she told me this, and he started in very Castaneda-like fashion singing opera. No, I do not want a liver transplant. And he said, don't name the disease because that fixes it, which is a very interesting point
phrase.
Of view.
We're going to have to take another little break very quickly. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. Sorcerer's Apprentice by Amy Wallace, her life with Carlos Castaneda. Finally, you can find out what was really going on behind the scenes of Carlos Castaneda's life. Amy Wallace was his lover for 20 years, his friend. Amy Wallace's book, Sorcerer's Apprentice, delves into the life of one of the most mysterious and powerful men of the 20th century. Was Carlos Castaneda really a sorcerer? Did Don Juan actually exist? You'll find all of this out and more. What was really going on with this extraordinary, wonderful, and dangerous man? Get it from the UnknownCountry.com store. You know, there's no other place in the world you can get information like this. I urge you to keep it going by subscribing to UnknownCountry.com. Probably you have not subscribed. Most of you haven't. About 1% of our newsletter readers have subscribed, and less than one half of 1% of our listeners to this radio program have subscribed. Less than one half of 1% of you have subscribed, but it's all dependent on you. If you lose this, and you could lose this now, that would be very sad. Take responsibility for this website. I put my time, my effort, my money into it. Annie does too, and so many other people do. You put a little of your money into it as well. We need you. Go to unknowncountry.com, click on that subscribe tab, enough said. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're back with Amy Wallace taking a magical mystery tour through the life of Carlos Castaneda, her life with Carlos Castaneda, her new book, Sorcerer's Apprentice. Amy, let me ask you now about love. You were, 17 when your father introduced you to Carlos?
Yes, and he seemed like a fatherly figure to me. There's 30 years age difference between us.
Yeah.
With the women that came to dine when we would have various dinners over the years, it did not seem like affairs. So after my father had died, I met, this woman, Florinda, again, because she wrote a book about magic, and suddenly it was a big reunion. Amy, we found you. Those were her words. We found you. Carlos will be so moved. And I received a call from Carlos. I never had his phone number. He would come and go. He would show up on the doorstep. He would say, I've been looking for you. But I could never guarantee reaching him. This went on for 20 years, and he kept up that mysterious quality of hiding his personal history. Well, after this reunion, he said, I didn't know your father had died. He was very fond of my father, and he said, I'm very upset, Chica, and he said, however, I have been in a state of dreaming. Now, he didn't like the term lucid dreaming, but I can't think of any better way to describe what he describes in his books, awareness while dreaming. And he said, I saw your father trapped on another plane, and he's worried about you, and he wanted me to save you. And I said, this is really weird. And he said, suspend your normal viewpoint and listen to me. He said, you are aware there is a metaphor here that only you can perceive. He's quite the flatterer. And come to Los Angeles, and we will attempt to free your father to a certain extent, and also see. I said, what's wrong with me? Why am I in trouble, in danger? And he said, I don't know. When we see each other, we'll begin. And that's where the story turned from sort of a friendship or acquaintanceship into a romance.
Florinda sounds like just old-fashioned seduction and taking advantage of a young girl to me, Amy. I can tell you.
I know. And I wasn't so young, but I was seducible, and he exactly, and you're not, and this is, you put your finger right on it. It's a little bit of flowers and candy there. And I went down to Los Angeles, and Florinda said to me, why don't you sleep with him? There's another name for Carlos. They called him, and Don Juan, they called him the Nopal, which is the supposedly a ancient term for the teacher,
right,
the one who has no ego. And she said that's the only way, sex magic is what she talked about. She said that's the only way to get you there faster, because we have so little time. So we have to move you quickly. And I said, Carlos seems like a father figure to me. That doesn't seem right. And she said, okay, but I want you to think about it. So she was already trying to set this up. But over the course of some months and various adventures, being kicked in and out of the group for not conforming or being suitable, Carlos took a walk by the beach with me, held my hand, and said, you have to sleep with a Nahual in order to link with the greater powers. And I thought, what an adventure.
Sounds suspicious. You seemed very naive when it came to Carlos, despite having been a married woman.
Yes, I was naive when it came to Carlos. It is true. This has to do with some issues in my past, which are, I, you know, probably seeking a father figure to a great extent when my father died. They're just missing my father very much. I was very naive. And you're quite right. And also, his charm was for me, it was very effective. It was very moving to me. And he wanted to have this meeting in a motel where we would have sex and it would be magic. And I thought it was a little awkward. And I said, I don't want to continue this and he said, that's okay, Chola. Just once the magical sperm of the Nahual has entered your brain, but you'll see that we're going to fall in love. And he wooed me and called six times a day and to tell me how much he loved me. And over time, I began to have a strong emotional feelings. I just feel that I was falling in love. And then he said he wanted to have a magical baby and we were going to get married. And I did not know that essentially I would be part of a harem, that there were 10, 20 other women.
Well, he made you move out of your house finally.
He made it a strong issue that I move out of my house and give up. For example, I had cats, and pets he thought were slaves, and no one should ever have a pet.
I think I'm a slave to my pets.
Yeah.
That's not very often the case, and but that was very sad. I did that to be a good warrior, and I moved to a location near him. And I gave away all my worldly possessions to erase my past. But the one thing that was very different in my case was that he did not ask me to cut ties with the remaining members of my family, whereas most people in the group, and I don't know if this is true in the Gurdjieff work.
No, it's not.
It's not. Okay, are asked to go to their, in Dr. Carlos's world, people were asked to go to their blood relations and say, you have no son, you have no daughter.
Oh.
Ouch. In my case, there was a magical incident where with my mother, who was getting on and not well, he said, why aren't you more loving? The opposite. And I said, well, you know, we've had a tough relationship. And he said, she's 80 years old. Show her some love. Say, I love you. And you'll find yourself loving her more. And I made it a practice. I tried it. And my brother said, this is interesting. You're acting differently. And I said, well, I didn't quote Carlos. I said, she's 80 years old. And my brother said, I'm going to do more of that as well. And my mother blossomed. And she said, my gosh, my friends have trouble with their children, and look what loving children I have. And in fact, I consider this a very magical act and gift. But this was exceptional. I was one of two people who, as far as I know, who were given this road. Others were people told to cut off in most brutal ways, and it caused tremendous pain. People felt their children had been abducted by a cult and came looking for them, and there were scenes, and oh, I can't tell you.
Well, he wanted you to give away all your father's manuscripts, but you didn't do it.
Right, exactly. I hid books my father had signed to me and so forth. He definitely put me in a very strange position, which I chose to. I mean, I chose to. He didn't force me. He set me up in the magical theater. This would be the stalking we talked about, where I had a pretend fiancé, but he called it the theater of the real, where I was to present this young man to my mother so that I could have more freedom to move and get away from family functions, because I had this new lover who lived in Europe, and I presented this young man to my family.
So they didn't know about your real relationship with him?
Absolutely not. Now, I did tell my brother for a while, and then Carlos asked me to untell him and everyone else. Once you've told people in the San Francisco Bay Area you're the fiancé of Castaneda, it goes around. He said, I want you to tell. This is very uncommon. And I said, why did you want this told, Carlos? And he said, because I wanted to see what New Agers would do when you said you were married to the Carlos Castaneda. And I said, what did you see? And he said, envy. Terrible envy. Aura.
In their energy bodies. And he claimed to be able to see these energy bodies, didn't he?
Yes. Now, I believe that we do have energetic aspects and that we can't see them. So that is not far-fetched for me.
Not me. But being able to see them as a separate body, that is bothers me, because it's one of those things that sets somebody on a pedestal. It's a claim that can't be proved or disproved.
It's precisely, and also, Whitley, you put your finger on it.
It's a dominance maneuver.
Touche. And you put your finger on it because he would go from one to another. I mean, he would say, first I see that, Whitley, and then he would say, then I see the next thing you don't see, which are these beings that eat our energies that he called the flyers. You can't see it. Then he'd say, I see the next level of beings. So he was always upping the ante with things that he could see and you couldn't.
And
that doesn't seem healthy.
Yeah, and then I was a guy who got dragged out of the house by his hair by these little creatures. So I have to tell you that I think they exist. In fact, I'd be damn surprised if they didn't. So,
but you wouldn't be too.
I'm coming at this interview.
Yeah.
We're going to have to take a little break in a second. But I just want to tell you, I'm coming at this interview from a different place than most everybody who will interview you about this book, and that is that, you know, I know that Carlos had to be on to something. I just don't know exactly how much he knew about what he was on to and whether it was using him or he was using it.
Beautifully said.
Yeah. Okay, let's stop for a second. Let's take a little break. We're going to talk about the loss of sorceric virginity when we get back. Get ready to curl your toes. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. Sorcerer's Apprentice by Amy Wallace, her life with Carlos Castaneda. Finally, you can find out what was really going on behind the scenes of Carlos Castaneda's life. Amy Wallace was his lover for 20 years, his friend. Amy Wallace's book, Sorcerer's Apprentice, delves into the life of one of the most mysterious and powerful men of the 20th century. Was Carlos Castaneda really a sorcerer? Did Don Juan actually exist? You'll find all of this out and more. What was really going on with this extraordinary, wonderful, and dangerous man? Get it from the UnknownCountry.com store. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We are back. We are talking with Amy Wallace, Sorcerer's Apprentice, her life with Carlos Castaneda. I mentioned the events that took place at the Los Angeles Wilshire Motel. Why don't we talk about that a little bit? Because this is, after all, what all of Carlos's seductions had been leading up to, I would think.
Yes, and I just want to say that before we got off the air, that you made a remark that was very powerful, that he was onto something, but was he leading it or was it leading him by the nose?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think this is a critical point. Anyway, he took me to this motel to lose my sorceric virginity.
Sounds like an old story, Amy.
I know. I love your Anne is a woman's remarks are so accurate. And he wanted to be, he had a very strong issue about his height. I'm 5'2", and he was 5'2", and he used to say, I'm short, brown, and homely. Well, he was not homely. And I didn't have any issues about how tall somebody was. And I had come over the years to find this man very attractive. He had changed his physical appearance a lot. He'd been kind of out of shape, and he'd been exercising and doing movements, which he called magical passes. And he looked, began to look attractive to me. And anyway, so we went to this motel, and we made love, and he claimed, and here's, I guess, the toe curler, that he said I was to intend, which is a very Carlosian word for those who have read the books, but I do believe there is intent in this world, intend his sperm up into my brain, which would burn away my humanity and make me closer to being a witch or some kind of inorganic being.
And he claimed not to be human.
He claimed to be beyond humanity.
I have to tell you that I think that that is a confession of weakness and a door which would open in his spirit, and that things that would come in that door would be free to manipulate him as they wished.
Well, you've been tested, I mean, I'm sure, in many ways, and I think that is a classical door of weakness when you think you're better than others. I broke with the group because one woman who remained when Carlos died, who was a witch, claimed there was a hierarchy of emptiness. And I said that we're beyond these hierarchies now.
Yeah, hierarchy is weakness. It's failure.
This is how I see it, and this is not also a successful way to impart wisdom, is
no,
to emphasize hierarchy.
Not at all.
It sounds
not
like he was buying his own version of things and had forgotten that he had, was the one who had created them.
Well, four stars right there, bingo, because this is what, I mean, in my opinion, this is very key to understanding what happened, if that's how I see it, that at a certain point it gets lonely at the top, as I'm sure you experienced with all the things that happened to you, Whitley, when you have very few people who can speak of your experiences. And you, for in Carlos's case, if you're a little unstable or you're ill, or he said he'd taken too many drugs and hurt his liver, then you start to believe in stories that you can fantasize, and you start to lose track of the real magic and the magic that makes you dominant in your stories.
Yes. Well, of course, and in my particular case, there was never any. There was initially a question in my mind about whether or not it was real, but by February of that year, after I first had the close encounter, I knew in myself that it was real, that it had actually happened, and therefore that the whole worldview that I had lived with was wrong. And sort of coming from that point, I mean, that's a really initiatory experience, of course. But let's go on. At the very beginning of the book, you have a, you've chosen quite a fabulous quote from Carlos, and I want to ask you about it. It is, there's going to come a time to put your cards on the table. Secrets kill us. Remember that. If you have secrets, I promise you, carajo, you'll die. I hope you understand if that time ever comes. If you die holding on to your precious secrets, you'll never be able to find me.
It's beautiful, isn't it? And there's power to it.
There's
Carajo
a lot of power to it, but at the same time, who is he that you know, it just, it is...
The ego of finding him, right?
There's a huge ego in there, too.
Well, he believes that if
power,
you don't...
It's an important statement, Amy.
Yes.
It's a true and real statement, but it's colored by this egotism that surrounds it.
If the statement had been without finding him as the ultimate goal, I think it would have had a lot more power.
If it had said, if you die holding on to your precious secret, you'll never be able to find yourself.
There you go.
Then it would have been a true statement entirely.
That's what I believe also.
Yet he had lots of secrets.
Oh, well,
you know. He did.
This was the also part, it was if I can pronounce it, Liberentine. And Florinda took me aside and said, if you ever think you'll come to the end of finding out our secrets, give it up, because there's secret upon secret upon secret. And then, I remember in the course of the same conversation, she said, I want to give you lessons in stalking and lying, essentially, and pretending and giving a good pitch for telling a story and making it believable, and she had me practice phony smiling. And that should not, I think, be necessary with a disciple.
This is Whitley Strieber with Ann Strieber on the IBC Radio Network. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland on the IBC Radio Network. We are back talking to Amy Wallace.
Well, it's also like saying you're an apprentice, but you'll never be a master because you'll never know it all. I mean, it's like a form of control.
Well, and here's Carlos leaving saying, you've never got, you know, all of you I've left behind. Well, your goal now is to find me, not it. Now, the thing that was so seductive about Carlos is that one of the things that prevented me from leaving was that often he would have more lucid days, moments, and speeches when he would say, I am human. He would change the tune, and he said, and the goal is not to find me, but to find it, the spirit. And so at those moments, I felt he was speaking truth, what I consider truth. Not to find spirit, but to be aligned with spirit, as it were. And then he would, on Tuesday, it would be different. I'm it. Without me, you're nothing.
He was at war with himself. To the end.
Right to the end. At the very end, he used to have a very grim tone, and he would say, fear guides me. Fear is what moves me through every minute of every day. And the famous Castaneda line, fear is, death is over your left shoulder, which you see in his book.
Yes.
And at the end, when he knew that he was going to die and probably die a conventional death. I don't know what he was thinking, but he had a diagnosis of cancer. He was saying to everyone, be a raccoon, because they eat everything. Live a splendid day. Live your life as if every second counts and be joyous. It's like at the very end, he changed the tune to that of a man who realized how precious every second was and was full of eagerness and joy to love it.
Mm-hmm. Well, everybody I've known near death has always changed like that.
Yeah.
I think it's something that will happen to all of us. There's one anecdote in the book, which I really like, because the same thing happened to Whitley. And this was when Carlos went to a book signing by Carlos Castaneda.
Did this happen to you?
I didn't go to a book signing, but there was a period of time when there was a person who was going on the radio as me,
and people would critique it. You know, I never heard of this.
Well, God, it happened to Stanley Kubrick. I found out there was a fellow living, dining all over Europe, saying, "I'm Stanley Kubrick," because Kubrick was reclusive
and probably getting free meals.
Oh, he lived for years like that in 4-star hotels, and finally got put in jail. But Carlos used to tell this wonderful story about going to some kind of party where a fellow had a table set up with books to sell, his own books.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, here I am, short, dark, and homely, and he was tall, blonde, and muscular.
Blonde? How could he be Carlos Castaneda blonde?
You make a point. That was part of the story.
The guy who went on the radio as me was actually quite a bit better than I was on the radio. He was really very, very well. I used to think to myself, I wish he would just, I could just quit and he could go on all the time. Better than I am.
Did you find this gentleman?
What?
What happened? I just have to know.
I never found it.
Oh, my God.
He just disappeared after a while when I was on the air, actually, with a someone. I think it might have been at a station in Kansas City. I was on the telephone, and the guy began talking about the last time I was on the air, and I realized, I said, you know what you're doing. You're talking about my imposter. I have an imposter out there.
Tremendous.
And because this didn't ever happen. In my world, in my life, And it was obvious from the conversation that the guy was really a lot better at being me than I am.
That's a very humbling experience. I had an experience with one of the survivors. After Carlos died, the witches, they disappeared en masse. And there's considerable reason to believe, although no proof, that they may have committed group suicide. One of them told me, I am going to commit suicide.
Mm.
And it was devastating. And the one woman who chose to remain was, the things she said were wrecking havoc with my feelings, because one day she'd say, they're dead, they're alive, they're dead, they're alive, they're killed themselves and not, they're dead, they're alive. And I just, that made me so nuts. I just wanted to break off finally.
That's terrible. Just awful.
It was devastating.
Yeah.
Again, that's manipulative. I mean, because knowing someone killed themselves is one of the worst feelings you could ever have. And to play with your emotions like that was cruel.
And there's a form of grieving that's natural. And then when you have suicide, you have some other feelings associated with it.
Yes.
And then the cruelty of it just was one of the...
And none of them have ever resurfaced.
No.
And
no.
What about, didn't he leave a considerable estate?
He left a considerable estate to these women and a few others, and in parsed out. And if these women aren't with us anymore, then all the money goes, the bulk of the money goes to the one woman who remained. I'm not in touch with her. I chose not to be. And who lives, I believe, in Los Angeles and is parsed out in some degree to some of the remaining students.
We're coming close to our time, the end of our time together, Amy, and I want to ask you a question on behalf of everybody probably who's listening. If I want to get into Carlos Castaneda, if I want to pick up his books and try to learn his system and try to do this warrior's way, is that a good idea or am I wasting my time?
Well, what an important and powerful final topic. Carlos, I'd like to share with you, wanted us not to read the books. He said, do not touch these books. They're old. They're the past. I don't want you reading my books. Don't treat them like the Bible. However, I have a favorite, which is Journey to Ixtlan. It's his third book. I think it's beautiful.
It's a fabulous book.
I have a permanent abiding love for that book. And I think that when Carlos said to me, Amy, there's a metaphor, it's if you can take those books and take the beauty of the metaphor and then take your own experience and be your own Nawal, so to speak, and realize the magic is inside you, you can take the beauty inside them. But if you become rigid about following, I have to do so many passes of this meditation technique, which Carlos didn't want, I think then you lose yourself in ritual.
So then you're saying essentially that there's nothing, is there nothing left now that he's passed?
I believe there's beauty in some of the early books in particular that's very powerful. And I mean, even at the middle of this, I've been going out with someone who wasn't familiar with this, and I said, I'd like you to read Journey to Ixtlan to understand the beauty that I saw and see in this. But the whole devoting your life to this, cutting off your, people you know, getting rid of all your belongings, I don't see power in this.
No, I don't either.
I think you're saying that people should not be fundamentalists.
Touché.
Yeah.
you put a cut to the bone there. Thank you. Yes.
Amy, are you free now?
I don't know if it's, I think it's a lifelong quest, but I must say I feel greatly healed by the experience of writing the book, and much of the anguish and grieving is passing away.
Well, it's just compulsive reading. It's fascinating.
Thank you.
Really, because actually, I have to tell you this, and this is to my listeners, if you really want to capture the spirit of Carlos Castaneda, this is the book to read, Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Well, thank you, Whitley.
Honored. It's the truth. It's quite a remarkable and, I think, extraordinarily honest work. I was really impressed by it because I know how much inner work it took to bring this out. It was not easy for you.
I'm very moved that you would say that, because there were times in writing it when I didn't think I could make it, because it was the pain of writing about the inner issues that led me to stay in a group.
Yes.
Became so cruel and ritualized to be a scapegoat. That was, it was hard to admit the flaws within myself, but it seemed to me that Carlos was right when he said, put your cards on the table. I do agree.
We find our freedom suddenly on any street corner, Amy, and
yes.
I think you have probably, you're on your way there if you are not already there. Sorcerer's Apprentice by Amy Wallace. And incidentally, I have one thing to ask of you. You didn't want to tell the story of what happened to you in that room with me that night. Will you at least say that something did happen?
Oh, goodness, yes. Lots of things have happened to me.
Okay, that's
Ooh.
All. She's very private about her stuff with this, and I really try to respect that, and I feel like I sort of went over a line earlier in the program, and I shouldn't have done it. And I just wanted to kind of leave the record straight.
Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. I'm very moved, and I'm very honored that you both have had me on. Thank you so very much.
Thank
good
you.
Luck on the journey, Amy.
Yes, Amy, good luck on the journey. Sorcerer's Apprentice by Amy Wallace. Don't miss this one, and not if you are on a real spiritual path, because this has got all the rocks and stumbles outlined for you, tell you how not to trip. This is Whitley Strieber, It's Dreamland. Linda Moulton Howe in just a minute. The work of Linda Moulton Howe, the amazing work of Linda Moulton Howe at earthfiles.com, plus her wonderful books, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1 and Volume 2, Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles, serious, big, beautifully edited books, beautifully illustrated, that tell you what you need to know about these mysteries. Don't miss them. Get them from unknowncountry.com and visit earthfiles.com if you want to find out what's really happening at and beyond the leading edge of science.
This is Ann Strieber. I'm urging you to read The Communion Letters. The close encounter experience has been seriously misrepresented in the media, even in the UFO press. These letters were written by folks just like you who actually had this happen to them. They are a true representative sample of the strangest, hardest, most dangerous, and most wonderful thing that has ever happened on this planet. Available only from the unknowncountry.com store.
One reporter who loves mysteries is radio's leading science journalist, Linda Moulton Howe. She's an Emmy Award-winning TV producer, documentary filmmaker, and writer who investigates new and unusual aspects of science, medicine, and the environment. Today, she has a special report for us on rising volcanic activity at Mount Rainier and in Yellowstone Park. Here she is from Philadelphia, Linda Moulton Howe.
Thanks, Whitley. Along the northwest coast of the United States and southern British Columbia, Canada, there is a volcanic range called the Cascades. There are 13 Cascade volcanoes which have been intermittently active for hundreds of thousands of years, the latest being Mount St. Helens in 1980. Another moderately active volcano is Mount Rainier, near Olympia and Tacoma, Washington, and could directly affect the lives of more than 100,000 people who now live on or near the lower slopes of that mountain. The 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens darkened the Pacific Northwest skies for days and produced huge landslides of mud, rock, and water called lahars, which move like concrete over everything in their path. You can see before and after photographs of Mount St. Helens at my website, www.earthfiles.com, in my report about volcanic and seismic threats to the northwest U.S. And if Mount Rainier blew off its top, as Mount St. Helens did, could that volcanic activity have a domino effect on the tectonic plates of the Pacific Ocean, now slowly sliding underneath the North American continent, and set off a 9-point earthquake on the Richter scale warned about by geologists? I talked about that question this week with Dr. William Scott, the U.S. Geological Survey's scientist in charge at the Cascades Volcano Observatory in Vancouver, Washington. Dr. Scott.
There's no close connection between those things. That there are two separate issues out here. One, they both occur because of the same geologic situation. But one is a very large earthquake that will occur out in the coastal region, and it really has nothing directly to do with Mount Rainier. And Mount Rainier will erupt in the future, and it won't necessarily be tied at all to this big earthquake. Now, they all derive from the same, what we call tectonic setting, the fact that a piece of the Northeast Pacific Ocean floor is being thrust underneath this part of North America, and it sets up the conditions to have both a large earthquake on the coast and this chain of volcanoes inland. So there's a general connection, but there's not a specific one-to-one kind of connection.
Okay, one might not necessarily set off the other, but that is a possibility.
Well, the last large earthquake occurred in the year 1700. And as far as we know, there was no eruption of any volcano during that time.
Do you know what the Richter level or guesstimated Richter level was in the 1700 earthquake?
Well, I think that the people who are studying that, I think they estimate that it's on the order of a magnitude 9.
It was?
Yes.
And today in 2003, focusing on that particular potential for a moment instead of the volcano, what is the likelihood that a 9 Richter earthquake could occur in the Pacific Northwest, say, in the next few years?
I don't know what the exact probability that those people are giving to it. That's a pretty complicated question. But these earthquakes have occurred in the past few thousand years. They've occurred as close as a few hundred years apart and as far as a thousand years apart. So, you know, it's difficult to say, but it's certain that sometime in the next, you know, few centuries to a thousand years that we'll have another one of these events. You know, everyone that lives here realizes that you know, it will occur someday, and that the states of Oregon and Washington and California and the province of British Columbia are all expending, time and money to try to mitigate the effects of those in terms of strengthening bridges and buildings and, public education, so that people will understand the threat both from the earthquake and then possibly from a large tsunami or sea wave that could follow the earthquake.
And if Mount Rainier went off as a volcano, would it affect the same geological area?
No. The effects of an eruption of Mount Rainier, the severe effects would certainly be much, much smaller than from that earthquake. I mean, that earthquake will affect areas from Northern California to Southern British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And Mount Rainier, an eruption of Mount Rainier, the farthest traveled effect would be just the ash drifting downwind. And that's not necessarily a life-threatening situation. The issue at Mount Rainier is in the valleys that drain the volcano that could carry these lahars. And there are a few valleys in particular that towns have moved in and developments occurred, so that there's, you know, several tens of thousands of people who would be in harm's way potentially.
But how many people do you estimate now live within a danger area of Mount Rainier if it did erupt?
Well, one figure that I've heard from the counties and cities is that the young, geologically young lahars from Mount Rainier, that there's probably something on the order of 150,000 people that live on those deposits. But the areas of greatest concern are smaller than that. But I've heard numbers in sort of the 30,000 person range, that are in, potentially at risk.
And how do you get, that quantity of people out on, what must be just 2-lane roads?
We've worked with one of the counties, Pierce County, to develop a warning system for these lahars that is always operating, and with the low probability that something potentially of concern could occur without warning or with very little warning, that system is up and operating, and the counties are working on, you know, evacuation planning and notification and so forth.
Is that a special kind of siren that can be heard for long distances?
Well, they're using a combination of ways of notifying people, and there's some notifications occur by pager. There are sirens. We have the National Weather Service operates a weather radio system that, you know, that gives warnings of hurricanes or tornadoes or whatever, and that there are plans to fold that into the mix so that people would be notified by through their radios or televisions. And there's a lot of work going on right now of how to alert that population, but the other important part of it is not just alerting them, but giving them the tools to know what's the best way out of the valley. And public officials have put up signs to mark evacuation routes, and there's an ongoing public education program that the counties and cities are doing so that citizens you know, will know what they're to do should the system ever go off. The scientific questions that we're working on have to do with how the volcano has grown in recent times, how large the eruptions have been, and the types of eruptions that have generated these lahars. Mount Rainier is covered with a large amount of glacier ice and perennial snow. So any kind of eruption that is able to mix hot material with snow and ice instantly generates large amounts of water that picks up debris and forms these lahars that go down the valleys.
Which can flood.
They're not just like water floods, but they're basically flows similar to wet concrete. It's rocks and mud and trees and water. So it's not a water flood. It's a flood of sediment and water.
Which it could be very destructive.
Which is very destructive. It's very dense and it can move relatively rapidly and it can, you know, smash structures or bury them.
In the data that you've collected over the decades, how much has Mount Rainier changed?
How much has it changed?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know that about 6,000 years ago, there was a very, very large landslide on Mount Rainier that basically removed the summit and the upper part of the volcano, larger than the great landslide that occurred at Mount St. Helens in 1980.
Hmm.
And that event made a very, very large lahar that went down several valleys all the way to the Puget Sound. And since that time, 6,000 years ago, the volcano has regrown, and much of the upper part of Mount Rainier that we see today is younger than 6,000 years old, which in geologic terms is very young. And we know that probably parts of the cone were built by eruptions as recently as 1,000 years ago and perhaps more recently than that. So you know, we're finding that the cone of the volcano has grown quite rapidly in the past few thousand years.
And is that rapid growth something that says that it could explode sooner than later?
Yeah, I think the message is that volcanoes don't erupt periodically. There's not a nice periodic rhythm to their eruption. Say that it erupts every 100 years. You know, that would make this business a lot easier. In fact, these volcanoes are quite episodic in their eruptions. They might erupt frequently for a period of several thousand years and then be relatively quiet for a period of several thousand years. And what it looks like is that Mount Rainier in the past, since this great event 6,000 years ago, has been quite frequently active.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seldom has a period of 500 to 1,000 years gone by without, you know, some kind of a significant eruption on the volcano.
And we would be now in what part of that cycle?
Well, because they're not, there's really not a cycle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know that the last significant event was on the order of about 500 years ago, and that since that time there have been a few small eruptions that haven't done a whole lot. So there's not a fixed time interval at which the volcano erupts, but you know it's been 500 years or more since the last sizable eruption, and so you know it would probably be reasonable to assume that in the next few centuries there probably will be a reasonable size eruption of Mount Rainier.
Further east of Mount Rainier in Washington State is Yellowstone National Park in the northwestern corner of Wyoming. Yellowstone is its own very large volcanic system with boiling geysers and mud flows that have entertained the public for decades. Yellowstone has not had any volcanic eruptions for tens of thousands of years, but in the summer of 2003, one public trail heated up to about the boiling point of water 212 degrees Fahrenheit. This week I talked with the United States Geological Survey scientist in charge of Yellowstone, Dr. Jacob Lowenstern, about the anomalous heating.
Well, most of the anomalous behavior is related to changes in the shallow hydrothermal system. They're shallow processes that are going on. Yellowstone is a volcanic system, but most of what we see at the surface is related to the hydrothermal system, which sits well above any deep magma. And the heat that rises off that magma heats up the hydrothermal system. There's lots of hot water. It's boiling underneath the ground. Steam rises, hot water rises, they come to the surface. And this year there's more boiling that's been observed in the North Geyser Basin. It's one of the several geyser basins scattered around Yellowstone National Park.
And is it true that some of the soil temperatures there reached as high as 200 degrees Fahrenheit?
That's right. Of course, that's a normal temperature for any steam vent at Yellowstone. That's the temperature of water when it's boiling. And so that's a common temperature, but this summer there were a variety of new vents that formed, and many of them were right around the trail that goes through the back basin of the North Geyser Basin. And so obviously when you have soil temperatures and new steam vents forming right along a trail, it presents hazardous conditions for the public, and so the Park Service prudently decided to close that area.
So that's how this became public, is that you had to close a trail because the temperature of the soil was so hot.
That's right.
And what do you think is about to happen where all of this soil has gotten so hot?
Well, we don't really know. It's very possible that it will just form new thermal areas. There will be new hot springs and fumaroles in that trail, and there won't be any more problems aside from that. This is not that uncommon in the Norris area. There's an area called the Ragged Hills that's just to the west, and that's been growing for the past 10 years. Slowly, increased boiling in the area, and new thermal features that are spreading to the west.
And as a geologist, do you worry about, I guess I want to say, volcanic or magma flows ever coming out in Yellowstone Park?
Well, it's always a possibility. It's not a high probability in any given year. Certainly there have been many volcanic eruptions in the Yellowstone area. There have been some that have been very, very large. But they've occurred in the distant past. The most recent was 640,000 years ago. Since then there have been about 30 different eruptions, most of them much smaller, and all of them much smaller. And the most recent lava flow was about 70,000 years ago. So it's always possible that we'll get another eruption at Yellowstone, and that's something that we do monitor and look out for. But it's not something that's likely in any given year.
Could an eruption of Mount Rainier into active volcanic eruption, or one of these possible 9-point on the Richter scale seismic events off the Pacific Northwest cause some kind of major eruption in Yellowstone?
An earthquake that far away, well, it's always possible. It's always possible, though it's certainly not something that we would think would be likely.
The U.S. Geological Survey's volcano observatories are using new technologies to measure movements of the Earth's crust. This is important because for a volcano to erupt, magma needs to move up to shallow levels, and this causes the ground surface to bulge and change shape. It might be only a few inches of movement over a few years, but these new technologies now can detect that rising land from global positioning systems. USGS is also using satellite radar imagery to look for broad regions on our planet that are being deformed. There is a 10-mile wide region now in the Three Sisters area of Central Oregon, in which the Earth's crust has risen about 7 inches in the past 5 years. USGS thinks that that 7-inch rise means magma is accumulating deep underground, but no one yet knows if it could be a warning that a surface eruption could happen there sometime in the future. This issue of ancient volcanism and huge seismic events has also come up in that question about megalithic structures off the western tip of Cuba
that I've reported about on Dreamland in the past, and I would like to let our Dreamland online listeners know that I'll be speaking in Laughlin, Nevada at the Ancient Earth Mysteries Conference, September 27th to 28th. My topic will be an update about that underwater megalithic structure or structures discovered off that western tip of Cuba, as well as other information about ancient Egypt links to Wiltshire, England. Other speakers at the Ancient Earth Mysteries Conference will be Jim Mars, Lynn Buchanan, Richard Dolan, Lauren Coleman, John Anthony West, Gail Ferguson, and John Alexander. If you go to my website, www.earthfiles.com, and near the top of the headlines page, click on the Ancient Earth Mysteries graphic for more information about tickets, location, program, and times. And I really hope to see Dreamland listeners there in Laughlin, Nevada, September 27th and 28th, as we explore these Earth mysteries that include the present issue of will there be volcanic and seismic activity in the Pacific Northwest, so huge now at a time when the population has never been denser, back to the ancient times when there weren't as many people, but there may have been land shifts so dramatic that a megalithic structure could be a half mile down off the tip of Cuba.
My word, what a report, Linda. And that conference sounds like a winner, I'm telling you. Earthfiles.com. Go there to find out about that conference. It's a Jim Mars, Linda Moulton Howe, Richard Dolan, even John Alexander, who knows more about that mysterious ranch owned by the National Institute for Discovery Sciences than anybody, and he is going to be talking about it. What a wow! That is fabulous. It's really going to be cool. Linda, I'd love to go there myself. If I have time, I will show up and
right.
Sit there in the back like a little old fly on the wall. Well, Linda, thank you very much for an excellent report, and we'll be talking again next week. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. Now we're going to fit in as much of the interview with Brian Vike as we can. This is a UFO investigator. He's been doing this for a couple of years in British Columbia. Brian is very effective, very professional. And he is the right man in the right time in the right place, because there is an awful lot of UFO activity going on up there. Prepare to have your hair curled, please. This is going to be really quite an exceptional interview. And remember, read that journal entry for this week and read the insight piece, the detailed description of the closer encounter experience he'll be talking about. If you want to download this, it's available. If you become a subscriber, and do that, please, become a subscriber. Keep this wonderful thing going at this time when it is so needed. This is Whitley Strieber. We're talking to Brian Vike, UFO investigator from Houston, British Columbia in Canada. That is not Houston, Texas, but up in Canada. And Brian has been following one of the more interesting UFO stories that have come along in a while. Brian, why don't you begin by letting us know a little bit about your background as in your interest in this subject?
Actually, there's not a whole lot to tell, actually, in some sense, but I started actually just not that long ago. It was in the end of 2000, and you know, I had a little bit of a background in astronomy, nothing, no doctorates or anything like that, and I just had pretty much an interest. And I started up this website, and I was getting the odd report come in, and I thought, well, this is not much sense of just collecting reports when people are good enough to send the information in, I should look into them. So that's where it all started, about 2000 end up. And then 2001 came along, and it picked up a little bit. I picked up some really nice, interesting things, crop circles. I investigated some cattle mutes at the end of 2001. And then when 2002 hit, all heck broke loose. I mean, I was running my feet off. I was running from town to town, investigating and interviewing people. I think in 2002 I ended up working on 107 cases, and some of them were just unbelievable.
Like, and what sort of cases?
Well, it started off there in February the 1st, 2002. There were three women that were coming home from Smithers, and they're heading home here to Houston, and they got to around Woodmere. It's a nursery there, and they saw quite a bright light in up in the sky, way ahead of them, and it. This light, you know, they all sort of, well, was it maybe the moon or something? and it descended down through the clouds on an angle towards them, still at a distance, and it dropped down to about tree level, treetop level, and this thing just came right at them and flew right over their vehicle, where they were so frightened that, well, there was people passing them on the road because everybody was just scared. They figured it was a boomerang in shape. An estimation, and this is a guesstimate, of over 400 feet wide. And I had confirmation from another fella who lived in Smithers, who actually went back to one of the video stores because he rented a movie that night, and he went back up the time and date to be sure, and then contacted me and says, "Mr. Vike, I seen exactly the same thing, although there wasn't a lot of detail given in the newspaper about it," and he described exactly what the three ladies seen. So even so, after time went by and I interviewed their ladies and so forth, there's one of the women that she refused. She didn't even go to work. She refused to leave her home, and while her husband was at work, she had children or her friends or family members come in and stay with her for weeks on end.
So she was obviously deeply terrified. Do you think it was anything more than a sighting?
Well, I think it ended up being that it was kind of funny because I put a lot of time into it, and it was funny because we were going to go down to my wife and I were going to fly down to Vancouver for my dad's 80th birthday, and we got on the aircraft, and actually it was canceled due to the weather, and then we ended up going back the next day, and we got on, they de-iced the wings, and they taxied out and took off, and the pilot came over the PA system and said, "We're going to make a slight detour or delay, you know, just go around a little bit about because there was military exercise taking place in the area." Well, of course, my ears perked up because this just, you know, the sighting of the boomerang had just happened. So I asked the stewardess, would she ask him again, the pilot, and just to verify that's what I heard, and she said, yes, sir, we're doing that, and it was due to military. Of course, I contacted the Comox military base on Vancouver Island, and nothing was happening. You know, nothing ever takes place, as I'm sure you know. And so anyways, after digging, and, you know, it almost came to a halt, but there was some other little things that came in there, too. You know, there were other people eventually who did see this. Some of the people, I believe, were the people that were actually speeding past these three ladies to get the heck out of there because it was so frightening. So, but, you know, that was just one of them. It's been like that up here for over the last 2 years now. It's just been hectic, absolutely, and amazing. I mean, sightings, for instance, here in 2002 again. I mean, people ask me, "Have you ever seen anything?" And I said, "I'm almost 52 years old," and I said, "No, I've never have until 2002. I jumped out of the chair here in the house, and I called my wife. And says, "Gosh, come and look at this." There was a. It was almost like you know, when you see a piece of space debris coming down, you have like a big plasma cloud.
Right.
And it was heading down sort of over and behind the mountain. And of course, I grabbed the binoculars. My wife was viewing it. And, I ran to get the camera. And of course, you know, the old story goes, you know, you miss it. It was, you know.
Oh, yeah. I'm familiar with that story.
Yeah. And that happened on August 23rd, 2002. And, that was the Friday evening. It was still daylight just before dusk. Well, on Monday morning, I had a lady call me, and she just lives just west of town here in Houston. And she said, "Mr. Vikes," she says, "I just seen the weirdest thing Friday night, but I got it on videotape. I got the whole thing on videotape." So I said, "Oh, boy, here we go." So I ran up, and I interviewed her and had a good chat with her. And she was kind enough to give me the videotape, and I brought it home, and I just about fell off the chair because it was exactly the same thing that we've seen. And so that's actually sitting up on the website for people to view. But about a month later, I had an email from people in Burns Lake.
Wait, just before we go on, folks, I know you're very interested in this website, and I'm going to say the name of it, and also if you'll be in the subscriber section, you'll be able to just click on his name. It'll say Brian Vike's website, and because it's a fairly complicated URL.
Mm-hmm.
It's HTTP /Wilbur8, /HBCC. And then there's a little line underneath, a lower line, UFO, another lower line, research.htm. Now, I'm fairly sure nobody followed that, but as I say, you can easily click through to it from the website. Okay, go ahead. Let's keep on about the email.
Okay. And then I was contacted about, like I was saying, about a month afterwards by a couple who were reside in Burns Lake, and they were out at the north end of Francois Lake, and this is on the same evening of the August 23rd. At the same time, we all had our sighting, and I guess they were sitting in their truck, and the husband went over, and he was going to get some pictures of the you know, sunset and so forth. And his wife's sitting in the vehicle, and I guess she was, you know, she had trees. There was a few trees in front of her, so she had sort of something she could focus on and watch this strange object. And it had not moved. It did not move one bit, and it sat there for approximately 5 to 6 minutes in one spot. And then her husband came back, and, of course, they discussed it. What is that? And all of a sudden, this object moved.
Now, exactly did it look like?
You know, it looks like a cloud almost. You know, it's long. It's long and almost the disc tubular shape. And the thing is, it's you know, and there's no tail behind it, nothing. It just sat there.
So now, did they see any color to it or anything?
No, it was like just completely white, just completely white. And
in other words, it's actually not even close to an airplane. That's what I'm trying.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, not at all. Not at all. It almost looked like a plasma cloud is what it looked like. A sort of long and quite narrow. But, you know, it did almost take some kind of a shape onto it. But, you know, it's hard to define that.
Yeah.
Although the pictures and the video's clear, but pardon me. But so what they seen, I don't know. But anyways, this moved on. Her husband did take two pictures of it, and they forwarded them to me. But what happened in the pictures, what they didn't notice was the three of them. So it made it quite an interesting story when I, you know, talked to everybody and got the information. But, you know, you try to follow up on something like that, and it's almost impossible. But, you know, because not too many people want to give out too much information, especially the, you know, places that might have the information, airports and like I say, the COMOX and whatnot, and even Department of National Defense. I had, pardon me, a fellow in there, and he was being really good to me. He was just acting on nothing secretive or nothing. It was through the Freedom of Information Act, but he was going and copying files and files and files and documents and sending them out to me, all Canadian reports, eh? And anyways, all of a sudden, some of these sightings started, and everything came to a complete halt, and I'd never heard from him. I don't know if he retired, so I don't want to make a conspiracy thing out of this, but, you know, if he retired or not, but I've had other people try to contact him, and no luck, so I don't know what happened. But, you know, that's just a couple of some of the strange things we had at Fraser Lake. A forester, an enforcement officer for the forestry. We also had one of the big head honchos at Fraser Lake Sawmills. They went out in the bush and they were walking one of the lines because they're ripping off all the block areas, you know, what's going to be logged. Pardon me. And, I guess they're walking along one and one of the fellows looked over and says, oh my gosh, what's that? And what they spotted was sort of a little mound. And as they, you know, it just looked unusual. So they walked over and they had a look. And here was a 20-foot circle, diameter, a 20-foot in diameter circle, completely scorched to the ground, okay, no vegetation, just dirt, with this moose carcass right in the very center of it.
Good Lord.
Hmm?
Good Lord.
I'm not kidding. This is ultra. And then, but the weird thing was, either side of the trees, like the trees that were facing, like there was some spruce and some aspen and there was some cottonwood in the area right around the circle. So either all the trees facing the circle all were scorched from the trunk right up to the top of the trees, all scorched and the leaves taken off on either side. So it almost, you know, if you want to look at it that way, and this is reaching, of course, from my end, is looking did something come from above and heat the whole area up where it actually caused so much heat and burnt all the vegetation and so forth and the carcass on the ground and all the leaves and branches and stuff like that. Well, the branches were still there. It was just the leaves, needles, and so forth on that deal. So there was another really weird one. And this is the stuff we've been getting up here.
Well, it's really fascinating. And Now, recently, there has been, you mentioned now 147 witnesses to a sighting. Just tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes, actually, that went up by about three people. It's actually 151 witnesses now. And this took place down in, actually, it's a little bit of a line in southeastern British Columbia. And people from Kamloops, Vernon, Kimberley, Cranbrook, Jaffrey, all that area, watched either an object or a ray or beam of light go across the sky from horizon to horizon. Now, most of the information I got was around the Kimberley, Cranbrook, Jaffrey, Cherryvale area, in the most southeast corner of British Columbia. And what they saw, what started off is a couple and their family, their children were out camping at St. Mary's Lake, which is 12 miles east of Kimberley. And, you know, it's a good popular campsite, so there was a number of people there. And the kids were out for the night, and this is about 12:45 in the morning, and they decide, well, we'll just have a little look at the stars and so forth, just basically sitting around and talking. And anyway, they looked up, and they seen this. They said what looked like a full, or the size of a moon, or the full moon object that was doing, was moving along, and they were quite surprised. And they said all of a sudden it did make some wobbling and zigzagging motions.
Mm.
And they watched this till it disappeared shortly after. No, I did some checking. I know the space station did go over that night at about 12:24, but that leaves what they've seen. There's two different things here, because one was so low, like it was just over the mountaintops, and it would actually drop down a little bit just below that, and then start shoot through the valley slowly. And then I had so that started there. So what this lady did, she reported it to the Kimberley Bulletin newspaper, and
right.
She was contacted by two people, and there was another person who did contact the paper. So I contacted the editor, and, of course, I couldn't get the name, but I did get the name off this Rhonda Brass, because she's in paper, too. So anyway, the contacted them, and then everything just snowballed from there after I wrote a letter to the paper, and a letter to the editor, actually, asking for help. Basically, I'm seeking witnesses for this incident. Well, from there, the phone never stopped ringing. I'm not kidding, Willie. It just never stopped. My wife would just sit here and shake her head.
Yeah.
And they just poured in night and day, all on the same thing. So, like I said, I ended up with 151 people. Now, here's some of the really weird stuff on this one. The object was all whoever seen the object, not all did, but watched this great big moon-sized white object traveling slowly, but it was doing some weird stuff. At one point, there's a family. It was beautiful in that country. It's nice and warm, so a lot of families will sit outside at night and have a little fire or just sit around just talking. And they watch this light, which they thought maybe it was a plane or a big bright star or something coming, you know, in their direction. And it was still in the distance. So, of course, as it got closer to them, it got larger, to where that everybody's, you know, watching this, was getting, you know, kind of jeepers. That's going to be right over top of the house. Well, it got so close that it scared the children. The children ran into the house. The wife followed, and so did the husband, because this is like just off the property now, very low. And as the husband just was going in, he sort of just looked, and this thing made a 90-degree turn and headed south.
And that's all we have time for right now on Free Dreamland. Subscribers can listen to the full interview and download it as they wish next week on Dreamland, The Lost Secret of Death, Robert Novak. Do not miss this program. He knows something terribly important about your soul. Thanks for listening to another edition of Dreamland. This is Whitley Strieber. Dreamland comes to you on unknowncountry.com, available for 1 p.m. Saturday afternoons. Also on the IBC Radio Network, available from 11 p.m. Saturday evenings at 7.385 kHz shortwave, repeated every weeknight at 1 a.m.